You're listening to Radio Freethinker, episode 76.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Rob, cognitive psychologist and informant on scumbag psychics.
Scumbag psychics, eh?
Yes.
I knew you were going to say that.
You scumbag. As some of you might know, I was in Portland for a cognitive science conference this past week. And while I was there, I had the dubious pleasure of realizing that the very hotel I was staying at was also hosting John Edward coming to do a group reading.
Wasn't John Edward the guy who ran to be president of the United States, or
that was Edwards.
Oh.
John Edward is the so-called psychic who hosted a show called Crossing Over with John Edward, where he had people in the audience and he would do the usual spitballing tactics, and when he got a hit, he'd claim to communicate with the loved one's deceased relative or something.
He would say things like, I'm getting a name that begins with B or W or R.
Exactly.
Or S or A.
I know someone named A.
Oh, yes. I know someone named A as well. Whoa, what a cool... So I saw this and I was like, wow, this is really annoying. So I looked him up, and in the context of telling my roommates at the conference hotel about who he is and what he does and what I do here in the skeptical community in Vancouver, and I found out his touring schedule and saw that he was coming to Vancouver. So posted on Twitter and Facebook, tipped you guys off, and to my great pleasure, the community here in Vancouver is so well organized and so quick to act that on almost no notice at all, you guys managed to organize and send out flyers right in front of the hotel that he was performing at here in Vancouver.
I should warn anyone, if you ever go to one of his shows, doing my little research on this, is what, apparently he shoots an 8-hour show sometimes and edits down to an hour for whatever, so...
I make people sign agreements that they won't talk to the media or explain what happened during the show to anybody after they've seen it.
But you were talking about skepticism.
Skepticism, yes. Well, it's interesting because Edward is, you know, psychic medium, whatever. So you think, okay, what's the harm, right? Big deal. Well, I think there actually is some pretty obvious harm with Edward. Not only does he take money from greeting people, he... offers them false hope, which I think is actually quite dangerous. He interrupts the natural grieving process people go through. Not only can his predictions be flat out wrong, they can interfere with someone's treasured memories of somebody, or they could just warp your relationship with someone who actually is living.
When you remember someone, your memory incorporates whatever is happening in the context during which you're remembering the memory. So it is a very real possibility that he's warping people's memories of their loved ones.
Exactly. Which is why we felt it was a very important thing to do, to go out there and try to encourage people to think critically about what Edward was saying. So it was our ongoing series of skepticism, which I believe, Don, you actually coined that term, did you not?
Yeah, the trademark is pending, although there are a few other people who are ahead of me that I'm working on eliminating.
Right. Well, basically what we did is we put together a flyer that essentially told people how to be a psychic like John Edward. And it's sort of based on several other flyers that were created by people like Ray Hyman or the Ottawa Skeptics. And we sort of kind of made our own version of it. And it was quite a bit different than, say, the Deepak Chopra flyer, which was more sort of kind of funny, but also had some key points about what Deepak was saying and then how he was completely and utterly wrong. Whereas this flyer was, I think, a bit more carefully worded. We were very aware that people who were going to see Edward, chances are they had just lost a loved one or were dealing with a very painful situation. So we were very careful to be very sensitive to their emotions on this. And so we started handing out the flyers. People took them, you know, people threw them away. One person mentioned that I was not open-minded enough to be a psychic like John Edwards, which is always fun. In one case, a couple of ladies offered us an extra ticket that they had that they didn't need. However, when they learned that we were skeptics of Edward, they wouldn't give us one. Apparently, our skepticism would drive away the ghosts they were hoping to see. I'm not being facetious. They actually told us that. They said that our skepticism would interfere with the spirit world. So we said, okay, well, thanks for the offer then, and enjoy your show. At one point, the hotel staff banished us to the sidewalk. This was taking place at the Marriott Hotel downtown in Vancouver. And so we sat on the sidewalk. We handed out a few more flyers. All in all, relatively quiet. There were no fireworks. One person was very angry to see us there, and we think he was the one who called hotel security on us, but...
Was it John Edward?
Well, it might have been John Edward, but no. We didn't
I mean, again, because as you mentioned, this is actually a very delicate area for skeptics as well, because people who are going to this are almost by definition vulnerable and desperate for something. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I'm glad to see that you took some effort to craft your letter properly.
Right.
Is that going to go on our website?
The radiofreethinker.com?
The Edwards note for...
Absolutely, we will have...
Because I would love if he goes to another town and he runs into the same...
Flyer.
Yeah. Well, I actually took the opportunity to send out a few emails to some people, some free thought groups where I know Edward is going next. And I don't suppose they're listening right now, but if they are, let us know how your event goes. Speaking of blogging, though, this event has been blogged a couple times. Ian Cromwell, the author of the Communist Manifesto, who was also a guest on our show a couple weeks back, blogged about it. And you know who else blogged about it? One P.Z. Myers discussed it again on his very popular blog, Pharyngula.
Pharyngulated again!
Yes.
I think he likes us. Well, Rob, you mentioned how you noticed Edward when you were away in Portland. What were you doing, though, in Portland?
I was in Portland for an academic conference called Cognitive Science. It's sponsored by the journal Cognitive Science and the Cognitive Science Society. And it took place over 3 days, and there were a ton of really interesting talks in every aspect of cognitive science you can imagine. And I actually saw a couple of really, really interesting talks there. I went to some that had bearing on some of our interests as skeptics.
Just for the lay people out there, cognitive science, what exactly is cognitive science?
I've been here for more than a year, and finally you're like, what the hell is it that you actually do, Rob? Cognitive science is concerned with taking, I guess, obviously, a scientific look at cognition. But what exactly cognition is somewhat of a point of contention. But the way I see it, and a sort of working definition that people seem to agree on, is that we seem to do certain things mentally. Things like be conscious, be aware of other things, have attentional aspects, think, reason, do judgments, perceive things. These are all aspects of cognition. And cognitive science is about trying to hash out what these things are and how they work. So this conference was a multidisciplinary conference set up so that people who work in every imaginable area of cognitive science, psychology, anthropology, computer modeling, computer science, pretty much everyone who does anything studying the mind and cognition.
What about parapsychology?
Parapsychology, I was not invited.
No psychics?
Although the two talks that I went to see had very supernatural aspects about them. So the one talk that I saw was about people's concepts of God. So there's this assumption in the literature that theists, people who believe in deities and God, have two conflicting concepts of God. One in which God is a physical entity that has abilities to manipulate with the world, interact with it, and is an anthropomorphic representation of people. And the other is this sort of abstract entity that is unknowable and immaterial and not necessarily able to be perceived directly. And so one idea is that, well, how do theists resolve this tension between these two opposing concepts, which are kind of logically incoherent? The guy whose talk I went to see, Andrew Stolman, thinks, well, this is an assumption people are making. How do we know that theists actually all hold both of these concepts simultaneously? And so he did a massive, large-scale survey and basically tested how people actually conceive of God. And he found that people actually fall into two camps, at least two camps, actually. One of them is the one that anthropomorphizes God and turns him into a physical entity, and the other is an abstract personification, and they don't really cross over. So it turns out that this assumption people had been making about theists, well, someone finally tested it and found that they don't actually have to resolve a conflict. And what was really interesting is that theists, according to the results of the survey, if they have an anthropomorphic personification of God, they construct a very, very strictly and like logically consistent theory of how the supernatural world and how religion and how God works in order to support this anthropomorphic personification of God. Namely that if they think God is a physical entity, then he has physical properties, and they are also much more likely to believe that angels and demons and Satan are all physical entities, that heaven and hell are physical places, that God can have physical interactions with the world and that he actually intervenes, and that these people are also far less likely to accept the ideas that the Big Bang or evolution happened without God's intervention, for example. So people will start from this usually quite normal intuition that if there is some intent behind the world, then it is an intent like ours, a person, not a person. That's like a weird new elementary particle. It's made out of persons. What's interesting is that these people are also more likely to deny the existence of physical scientific entities like subatomic particles. That's a separate survey, though. So I just thought it was interesting that theists who have an anthropomorphized version of God construct this whole system just to make it make sense.
Well, that's pretty interesting there, Rob. Why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie, to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member. get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Rob's telling us about his time in Portland at the Cognitive Science Conference there.
And you left us with a cliffhanger. You were telling us about the religious believing people who believe in, like, the real personal God. So what about these other people who believe in sort of the airy-fairy spiritual type God?
Well, this is the part that I wanted actually a lot more information about, but unfortunately the constraints of the survey methods the researcher was using, basically what it revealed was that there is massive clustering and statistical significance around the people who have this personal God in relation to all the other, you know, personal and physical and real entities that they think of when they think of as spiritual entities. The more abstract notions of God vary widely in how they conceive of the reality of entities like angels or heaven or Satan. So basically what it means that when you have a more nuanced view of God, you don't fit into the same sort of really strongly believing category as people who have a personal anthropomorphized view of God.
Okay. So one's like a real illness, the other one's more of a spectrum.
Yeah, kind of. Oh, dear. I think we might get some angry letters for describing it as an illness. But Andrew Stallman actually did another survey study, which had a really fun title. Judging competence... confidence in judging scientific and supernatural claims without competence. And
that's really funny.
Well, basically, it amused me because it's something that you see all the time. It's people having really strongly a strong belief in some scientific or supernatural claim without actually knowing anything about it.
But
confidence without competence.
Yeah, but that's actually quite a very common... I mean, because in a modern technological society, I mean, I use my cell phone and I know everything about myself. I have really no idea how the cell phone technically works, right? So but I'm assuming you don't mean
if you had confidence in how something worked entirely without understanding anything behind it. So the example and actually his methodology was another large-scale survey where he asked people to rate how confident they were in the existence or non-existence of a number of physical scientific entities such as electrons or gravity or things like that, or supernatural entities like fairies or God or karma. And what he found was that when people were really confident, and the important aspect was after all these things, he gave them the box where they could have a free explanation of their reason for believing this. So why did you believe this? And he found that broadly people fit into three sorts of categories. One was because they felt very strongly that it was true, a subjective account. Another was deferential to some other source. I believe this because this person told me to, or this source said so. And the third was evidence. So one flag that's going off here is that people aren't relying exclusively on evidence to support their beliefs. In fact, when he actually showed us the graphs, most people, 90% of people, were basing their confidence in various claims, whether they be supernatural or scientific, was because some other source had told them, and that was it. When asked to go into further, they basically said, I believe this because I trust my high school physics teacher, or I believe this because I trust my, you know, pastor.
Or I believe this because Radio Free Thinker said it.
Yeah. The evidence didn't really enter into the equation. And the next lowest was a subjective feeling that it was true. And then finally, at the very bottom, was evidence. Now, what I thought was interesting was that he actually had to exclude about just a bit less than a third of the respondents because they denied fewer than three scientific entities as being real. So, and what was interesting about this was the only thing that he really told us was that these people did rely on evidence. And I was like, well, come on, this is the interesting group. What makes these people different from the people that rely almost exclusively on appeals to authority? So I really hope that he goes into that research further. But the thing that really I found interesting was that, and this was a population of students at a university, that they appealed to authority 90% of the time, whether it was a scientific or supernatural claim.
But, sorry, and see, now you've got me confused in this study. Maybe I passed out somewhere along the way. So he did his research into people who believe non-scientific things and trying to figure out how they justify that belief, which is why he excluded right from the beginning anyone who didn't believe in a lot of non-scientific things.
So yeah,
that's
exactly
why there's that split.
He excluded the people who believed in lots of scientific things and denied most non-scientific things because he wanted to see how people who believed in both about an equal level would possibly differ in their reasons for doing so. But he found that they didn't actually differ, that they had pretty much the same reasons for believing in either scientific or supernatural claims. And the reason was usually because someone told them to.
So doesn't this speak then to the amount of critical thinking that students are actually getting exposed to?
I think it does. Definitely, if people are appealing more to authority rather than their own ability to consider the evidence for and against the claim, that means that it seems that people are just not being taught to consider evidence. However, I do also think that there is cognitive bias happening here. When someone you trust tells you something, it's difficult to question it without questioning everything else that you trust about that person. It's probably some kind of cognitive dissonance that prevents you from going too far into, well, let's check this source, but I already trust this source. Yeah, brain explode.
Well, I think this also kind of speaks to something that we've talked about in the past, and that is properly preparing textbooks for students. If they read in a textbook that, for example, Thomas Jefferson isn't important, or that evolution is just a theory, that's going to have a far bigger impact on a child and their thinking about authority and science than it's going to have if they sat them down and tried to explain the evidence behind it.
Not just in science, as we see. Scientific claims, supernatural claims, and as you suggest, if the textbook from their childhood is telling them that Thomas Jefferson didn't matter, then based on this survey, 90% of them are just going to keep on believing that because the textbook told them so.
Well,
so it's really, really important. I think it's crucial to teach people to question textbooks.
Well, there's another aspect to this, too, and I don't know if this study went into it, but, I mean, we live in sort of an anti-intellectual society, right? I mean, people are much more worried about football stars than science stars, and this show might be an exception to that matter.
Science stars?
Well, like a Stephen Hawking.
Hey, don't laugh. At the conference, there was a lot of celebrity cognitive scientist spotting, and we were going giddy when we saw, like, people like, oh, my God, it's Michael Spivey.
Yeah, no. So, but that leads to the thing is that, you know, one of the reasons why maybe a lot of these people believed in these things based on what other people have said is because they just didn't want to go to the effort to think about them, right? So, I mean, someone would say, well, who cares about evolution? It doesn't affect me in my daily life. And if we live in a society that wants to make people think more about what's happening with Britney Spears on the weekend and less about, you know, how can science actually affect your life and how this actually... People tend not to be thinking as much, and that's another aspect of it. I mean, it starts in school, but it permeates throughout society where people just, they don't want to think about it. So evidence isn't important to them. They don't even want to think about real questions, so they're willing to just go by default. Well, I don't want to think about it. My brother says this or what have you, so...
Yeah, there's an idea that people have some people have a like for cognition, that they need to think, or they enjoy thinking, but... I'm guessing that the vast majority of the regular population doesn't really enjoy thinking too hard about things. And if someone they trust tells them something, they're just going to, okay, sure, I accept that.
And even that can be very difficult because, you know, I ran into a story the other day about a school in Barrie, Ontario, parents in Barrie, Ontario, it's part of Simcoe County, that their children, they're showing up with a whole bunch of symptoms. They're ranging from headaches, dizziness, nausea, even racing heart rates. I mean, scary stuff, right? And parents are complaining that the school board isn't taking them seriously, that even though these symptoms all disappear on the weekend, right? So they figure it has to be coming from the school. Now, of course, what do you think it could be that they're worried about? Anyone?
Poison milk.
No. Sugar in the cafeteria food. Too much of it.
You know, all those might be valid things, but it's another case where the internet is killing our children. In this particular case, Wi-Fi. They're blaming, these parents are blaming Wi-Fi signals. Apparently the school switched over to Wi-Fi, I think over a year ago, or just under a year ago. And these parents are saying the school board has to shut down the Wi-Fi because that's the cause of their children. Now, to the credit of the school
based
district.
Based on what evidence?
According to the school district, and I'm proud of them in this, they say, no, you're nuts. There's no scientific or medical evidence. They didn't say nuts. They have to be political. They said there's no scientific or medical evidence to show that the children's complaints have anything to do with Wi-Fi in the thing. So they've refused to shut down the Wi-Fi. So I did a bit of research into this just to find out, you know, where this all come from. And there was a big scare in 2007 in the UK about Wi-Fi signals causing brain cancer. The same kind of things you hear about cell phones was kind of going around for Wi-Fi. Now, of course, in looking at all their claims, they were self-referencing other news programs, right? So Paranormal would do Nova would do, you know, so there was kind of an inbreeding. The CBC cites a person named Susan Clark, who apparently is a former research consultant at the Harvard School for Public Health, who says that Wi-Fi technology fundamentally affects the physiological function and neurological conditions of the brain and the cardiac system. So I'm going, well, okay, where did they get this? So I did a bit more digging. And most of these claims seem to stem from a research paper from a Dr. Zorak R. Glasser, which I really hope is an acronym and this is fake. That's such a bizarre name. Zorak. Wasn't he the founder?
Dr. Zorak.
Sounds like a Superman villain or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, or the founder of the Mormon Church, wasn't he, or something? It was Zorak, wasn't he?
Joseph Smith.
Zenon, sorry. So anyhow, apparently he did a paper for the Medical Research Institute. And paper's not quite the right thing. It's more of a meta-research. There's a PDF version online, which I looked at.
But what do you mean by meta-research? Is it like a review of other people's research or a meta-statistical analysis?
It makes reference that he looked over 4,000 or 2,000 some odd study. I think it's 2,700 other studies, right? And he came up with some things that apparently happened. Now, you were asking, what is this all about? Well, it seemed to have been the point of research paper was to find out how you can weaponize radio waves. So it was like, well, you could use radio waves maybe to make people sick, maybe to do this, maybe to do that. And all this information was called from that. But this document itself comes from 1972. So, I mean, it's kind of dubiously sourced. It's way out of date. And the focus of it, again, it wasn't data research, it wasn't statistical analysis. It was like he read over this stuff and he was brainstorming, what might we be able to do with this? And he says, well, you might be able to do that and you might be able to do this. He was making some genetic, you might be able to alter someone's genetics with radio waves. And it struck me as really quite bizarre. Now, the fundamental point of this in the end, if we say, well, okay, maybe it is the Wi-Fi, but then you're left with the other problem, why the school board didn't go with it, is you have about 12 kids that are being infected out of 50,000 that are being exposed to it. Not to mention, we're being exposed to it right here and right now.
Yeah, I mean, like, if it was Wi-Fi and it did have these kinds of effects, we would constantly be experiencing them because there's Wi-Fi everywhere now. I mean, in this situation, you don't even need to, you know, check the source and make sure that the paper that everyone's been reporting off of was legit, which in this case it seems it wasn't, or in any case, it wasn't saying what people are saying it was saying. You just need to compare to other school districts that have had Wi-Fi for longer.
Or even right here. I mean, right now we're being affected with Wi-Fi.
Don is having a few technical difficulties, so yeah, we'll be speaking with him after this commercial break.
Just to close this out, just so you guys all know, the CBC online poll said, are you concerned with Wi-Fi potential risk?
Very
22%
scientific.
Said yes, 78% said no. What does that mean? Nothing, I'm sure.
Well, good quality reporting from the CBC. Let's go to a commercial break on Radio Freethinker.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
This is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So you guys remember back on episode 57, we discussed whether or not the Pope is a criminal?
Yes, didn't we try and convict him in absentia, and if he ever comes to Canada, we've got a warrant for his arrest or something?
I don't think that was us, but it might be a good cause. Now, that discussion that we had was based on sort of recent news stories that were surfacing about childhood sexual abuse by Catholic priests. And when the Pope was a cardinal, back when before he was the Divine Pope, he was in a position to stop these abuses and punish the abusers. Instead, many priests escaped punishment, their crimes were not publicized, and in several cases, these pedophiles were able to continue harming children. Now, how this all linked back to Cardinal Ratzinger, who is the Pope's real name, was that he was directly responsible for investigating these cases. And based on several allegations, he failed to do so. In fact, he may even be directly responsible for allowing a priest to escape punishment, as in the case of Reverend Lawrence C. Murphy, who allegedly molested over 200 boys while serving at a school for the deaf in the United States.
Just to add a quick point of clarification, or you could just... So when you say he wasn't punished or anything, do you mean he wasn't punished by the secular authorities, by the cops, or by the church, or by neither?
Neither. In the case of abuse, what the standard procedure apparently is that this council that Cardinal Ratzinger was on is supposed to call this sort of meeting. And they put up the priest in question sort of in this kind of trial. And if he's convicted of this trial, then maybe they take it to the civil authorities. In which case, however, the Pope stopped the trial of this one particular priest, Lawrence C. Murphy. And furthermore, he was not handed over to local authorities. He was sort of sequestered and moved to a different parish where he probably continued to molest children. So pretty big charges. And that was sort of the basis of our discussion all those while ago.
So why are we coming back to it now?
Well, you see, the Pope is visiting the UK in September. It's kind of around the same time Rob is going to
Yes, I'm going there to meet the Pope. Actually, when I was looking at local skeptic and humanist and scientific reasoning, critical thinking groups on Meetup to sign up for when I get to London, there is a massive Meetup group. There's thousands of people in it that are setting up basically to protest the Pope's visit to the UK.
I wonder if any of them are going to try, and this is a recommendation, try and commit a citizen's arrest. I know they've done that with people like Kissinger and all who've been accused of war crimes, but you know, you can do citizen's arrest. You can say, listen, I think you've done a crime and I'm arresting you. Do you think you might be able to, you know,
citizen's arrest of the Pope?
A citizen's arrest of the Pope?
You got to watch over those Swiss guards, though.
Yeah, they got some funny hats.
Yeah. So obviously, the Pope's upcoming visit is a subject of intense debate. And I was sort of looking at some of the local stories in the UK about this. I listened to a couple debates online. Some of them were kind of interesting. What I found was very interesting was that the reasons people are coming up to ban the Pope, essentially, are a little odd.
To ban the Pope from entering the country or from giving a speech or what?
To just keep him out, essentially. And there's a whole list of reasons, and maybe I'll read some of them to you guys here. For example, the Pope opposes women's ordination, which is sort of a misogynist, sexist thing to do. The Pope says artificial contraception is a sin, which is, I think, kind of cold. And I don't think he has any information on artificial
That was actually one of the main points of contention during the election in Poland when I was there about a month ago.
Right.
Well, you know, people were talking about whether or not a particular presidential candidate was in favor or against in vitro fertilization because the Pope said that it was, you know, a sin. And I'm just like, holy man, how are you, like, behind, so far behind the rest of the world?
It's a good question. The Pope also rejects potentially life-saving embryonic stem cell research. Apparently, the Pope also has a degree in biotechnology or something. He's also denounced the use of condoms, even to stop the spread of HIV. He's also claimed that condom usage may actually increase the rate of HIV infection, which is completely and utterly insane and ridiculous.
Well, and it's through him and the bishops that he supports in Africa that have been directly attributed to killing millions and millions of people for this policy. I mean, this is something that actually has a bigger life and death effect than his other crimes. But, I mean, it does seem to be, we were talking about Kissinger a second ago about war crimes, and, I mean, in some senses, I mean, if you kill millions of people through your direct actions...
Mm-hmm. Well, so the Pope says a lot of things and spreads a lot of misinformation that through other people's actions may lead to death. Okay, right. That given. What are some other reasons people are saying he should be banned from entering the UK?
Well, I mean, there's a whole list of things that you could find offensive about the Pope. I mean, this is the guy who authored a Vatican document that condemned homosexuality as a, quote, objective disorder and, quote, a strong tendency towards an intrinsic moral evil. So pretty awful things. Now, I'm sure everyone would agree with me that these are all intolerant, ill-informed, deplorable views to have, but they are opinions that the Pope is allowed to have. They're not criminal in nature. The HIV thing is, I think we could probably debate that pretty thoroughly.
If we let Rush Limbaugh have a radio show, the Pope should be allowed to speak.
Right. So these seem matters of free speech, and they're not really a good reason to ban somebody from your country.
In your opinion.
So always correct opinion.
The only difference I'd make a split of hair between Rush Limbaugh and the Pope is if Obama said that we should kill Whitey, and suddenly there was a huge outbreak of violence, you would blame him for that in a way different than you would Rush Limbaugh because of his power, his position. The Pope is not the average individual, and because of the power of his position, I think you can hold him not only morally but more legally responsible. But that's my opinion.
Right.
And let's continue on with this free speech debate.
So what are some perhaps more concrete reasons to want to keep the Pope out? One of them is money. Now, the UK taxpayer is paying for a large percentage of this trip. The total cost is estimated to be around £24 million, which, remember, pounds are more expensive than
dollars.
It's about
$2.50.
Right. Now, about $12 million of that is going to be paid by the British government. And by extension, that's going to come from the taxpayer. The rest is going to be fronted by the Vatican.
I, of course, assumed, I mean, they do that when the Dalai Lama shows up, when the Grand Mufti shows up, when, you know, the Eastern Orthodox Grand Patriarch shows up. I mean, did they pay for all of their expense? Well, part of their expenses as well?
I don't know.
It's a no. Sorry.
Okay. Well,
that was a leading question. I apologize, Ethan.
No, that's a good point, though.
But he does. They don't support in the same way that they seem to be supporting the Pope.
See, the difference here is that the Pope is, quote, a head of state. Now, that's well and good, but he's also a faith-based practitioner. So you have a huge percentage of the UK population paying the expenses of someone coming to advance their religion.
I'm sort of just thinking right now, and is the percentage of the cost that is being paid by British taxpayers equal or less than the percentage of British taxpayers who are Catholics who support the Pope coming into the UK?
It's a good question.
Because if it's more, then you run into this problem of, well, why are people who don't want the Pope to come to the state paying for him to do so?
Yeah. I would just hazard a guess that it's going to be everybody in the UK is going to feel some of this Pope tax, but I don't have any evidence behind that at the moment. Now, what's interesting is that Archbishop Vincent Nicholas, who is, I assume, an authority in the UK, pointed out, and I'm going to quote him here, "I would like to stress from our point of view that not a penny is expected from public funds for those aspects of the visit which are expressions of Catholic faith." So basically saying, because the Pope is doing both sort of a state visit and also a religious visit, he's going to be doing a lot of prayer services and whatever it is they do that are religious visits, visiting Westminster Abbey and the like. That is not going to be paid for by the UK taxpayer, according to this archbishop. Now, keeping in mind that this does not include any of the security costs, which we're all familiar with here, and how much security costs can be.
So I'm confused then. I mean, besides his religious duties, what is the 12 million at least, what does that go for? I mean, I don't think there's a lot of oil exports from the Vatican to the UK, and I haven't heard of their large manufacturing concerns, although I imagine they have a fair amount of investments, but...
Sure, definitely. Well, that's a good question. Exactly what is he spending 12 million pounds on in terms of state visits? I would presume... probably his diplomatic ambassador hotel. I know he's meeting with the Queen.
Fuel for the Pope Mobile.
Yeah, there you go.
When he meets the Queen, is he meeting her as head of state or as monarch? Because those are two different hats.
That's a good question.
So if he's there as a diplomat and as a religious leader, is the religious leader meeting the head of state or the crown?
Or is the head of state meeting a different head of the church?
Exactly.
So that's a really interesting question there. Now, the other aspect to this is, well, if the Pope is in fact a criminal, if he bears some responsibility for not stopping childhood sexual abuse across the world when he was in a position to do so, if in any remote possible way we consider him a criminal, why are the British people being asked to pay 12 million pounds to give this guy a vacation?
I think this has, like, clearly the most valid possible reason to keep the Pope out of the UK.
So, not surprisingly, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens have been spearheading an attempt to have criminal charges placed on Ratzinger. Hitchens wrote in a recent article in Free Inquiry magazine that the Vatican announced that any legal action against the Pope will result in a claim of sovereign immunity, which is essentially diplomatic immunity. He's the head of state. He cannot be tried by another country's court. Now, in the research that I did, I could not find a definitive answer to whether a claim of sovereign immunity would hold up. Now, Hitchens doesn't consider the treaty that created the Holy See legitimate, which is his opinion. Really, I don't think there's any legal avenue in that regard. I don't think it's a widely held belief either, so that probably won't fly. Now, some people say that because sovereign immunity protects you from another nation's court, it does not protect you from international courts, like the UN or the World Court. Other sources say that it does protect you from the UN, but not local governments. So there's actually quite a bit of confusion about this.
Are there any lawyers that are working on...
Yes, well, Dawkins and Hitchens have hired a team of lawyers to pursue this. And there's been a lot of debate back and forth whether or not this is actually a useful or even worthwhile attempt. Some people are saying that it's actually just foolish.
It is. It does sort of sound a bit like a publicity stunt, doesn't it?
Well, right. This is where it gets kind of interesting, because, I mean, right now, Charles Taylor, who used to be the head of state for Liberia, I think it was, or is it the Ivory Coast, is being charged for crimes against humanity because he was dealing in blood diamonds, selling diamonds to... buy children. I'm not sure on the exact details, but he bought children to fight his war. So children, he was sending children into battle.
So basically, he did all sorts of really horrible things.
Well, no, it's important here. He was abusing children. He wasn't sexually abusing them. He was abusing them in the sense of violent war. In which case, going back to the Pope, I mean, our main contention here, or at least Hitchens and them contention, is that the Pope indirectly caused the abuse of children, or knew about and did not stop, or facilitated in some way. So I think the same kind of criminal activity could be going back to, again, you should arrest him in a citizen's arrest for crimes against humanity.
See what I can do.
So I think, I don't know, this is not necessarily something that will happen, but I think at least it sets a precedent that maybe in the future.
Well, the other aspect of this, and I'm kind of going along what Don was just saying, is going through the difficulty, trying to figure out exactly what the Pope is. I mean, we're talking about, is he a religious figure? Is he a head of state? Part of that difficulty is knowing what exactly he is the head of state of.
The Vatican?
The Vatican is sometimes referred to as a sovereign state, which I think is actually incorrect. Vatican City is independent of Italy, which was done through the Treaty of Lateran between Mussolini and the Pope of the time, back when the Kingdom of Italy first formed. In a recent Los Angeles Times article, two law professors evaluated the Vatican's claim to statehood based on sort of four criteria of international law, and what they argued was that it has neither significant territory nor a permanent population, It has a functioning government, but no justice or education system, and only ceremonial defense. So,
well, first of all, just to correct you, the Vatican was created by Mussolini as part of a deal, but that was several decades after the creation of Italy itself.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Okay, but to be fair, there are actually even smaller nations. San Marino, which also happens to be in Italy, which I think is the smallest sovereign state. There's Andorra, mm-hmm. which is also a very small. So I don't know if the size argument would make it. Actually, I think I'd be more worried about the confusion between what the Holy See means.
That's the other big problem. The Pope is considered head of state of the Holy See, which actually encompasses all of Catholicism, presumably Vatican City. Now, by most legal definitions of what states are, neither Vatican City nor the Holy See do qualify. However, for some reason, they both seem to have separate and distinct legal status as independent nations. So both the Holy See and Vatican City are considered independent states, independent of each other and different from each other.
This is weird.
It's weird. And my question is to you guys and everyone else listening is, should the main goal of all this fuss with Richard Dawkins and the legal battles and all this debate be to figure out this complicated mess of international law and treaties trying to define what the Pope can legally be charged with, or should this be more of a symbolic effort to embarrass the UK into not spending $12 million of taxpayers' money bringing in a suspected child abuse
facilitator?
Oh, actually, I think just not that. It's the idea that should he, because he is a religious person, be granted somehow special consideration, whereas if this was, if Harper, and I'm not saying Harper would, but if Harper had done the same things that the Pope had done, we would probably be much more likely to arrest him and charge him, or at least, you know, withdraw our invitation for him to visit England, you know what I mean?
Even still, like, if Harper was the head of a school system that was worldwide and crimes were happening in other nations that Harper was going to go visit, would he not be arrested in those nations?
Well, and that's where I think there's a third option you're having in there, too, is this an active, an effective way of saying that just because it's a religious activity, it should not be treated any differently than if it was any other activity. So just because he is a religious leader, you shouldn't treat him differently because of that. Mm-hmm. So if it's a bad thing he's done, then you should treat him as you would anyone else who had done a bad thing.
Exactly. Well, if this does actually work and people do discover the legal status of the Vatican, the Holy See, and any claims that there are regarding the legal status of the Pope, then it will be really, really useful to resolve any other arguments that might result from any legal aspect of the Vatican or the Pope's involvement in any crime or anything that they do. If it's not been resolved till now, then this is a good opportunity to do it. But there is one thing that you probably can very definitely arrest the Pope for, and that is dissolving the Galactic Empire and establishing the evil empire and hiring Darth Vader as his right hand. Wait, no, that was Emperor Palpatine. Sorry, never mind.
Rather obscure. So, on that note, maybe we should...
Well, let's take a commercial break and let our audience recharge their galactic papacy batteries or something.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A plus, here I come.
We're back on Radio Freethinker. Rob, this is conceivably your last show for a good long while. Anyway, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing here? And, you know, I wouldn't mind knowing how you got on the show or who you are, really.
What am I doing here? Where am I? Who are you people?
Should I call security now?
Well, I got involved in the show when it was almost entirely random. It was a spur of the moment thing when the UBC Freethinker Society, headed by Elon at the time, decided to hold a meeting to discuss the possibility of doing a radio show for the club on CITR. And I went to the meeting, and people talked about what sort of things would need to be done. And when the subject of who wanted to host it came up, I just completely randomly decided to raise my hand. And there we went. I wasn't even a member of the UBC Freethinker Society. I just decided to show up because I thought it would be interesting.
Well, and it turned out to be very interesting indeed.
Yeah. And as far as what it is I actually do here in general, I mean, I start most shows by saying, hi, I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist. And I am an active researcher. I was paid for research at the Brain Attention Research Lab here at UBC, headed by principal investigator Alan Kingstone. And I do research into social attention, visual attention, and social cognition. And that's what I actually came down to present at the Cognitive Science Conference in Portland. I printed up a poster and stood in front of it and explained to anyone who would walk by about my research. So I can do that now.
Now, I have to assume that there's some form of copyright protection or something, because although you've said everything about what you've done, you haven't actually said what this poster was or what. So you've done cognitive research, and this poster was of naked flamingos doing a Charleston on the back of a whale.
I actually presented an early version of this poster at another conference in Bellingham. That's up on my website, robteschka.wordpress.com, and I will be putting up the new version of the poster there so everyone can look at it, and I will link to it from the Radio Freethinker website. But it's called Now You See It, Now You Don't: Magic and Social Attention. So the other thing that I say sometimes when introducing myself on the show is that I'm an amateur magician. So I've combined the two into this research program where I'm collaborating with a guy called Gustav Kuhn, who's currently at Brunel University in the UK, and he has this idea that every time a magician performs a trick, he's basically doing an experiment in social attention. Magic tricks are designed to direct your attention to wherever the magician needs it to be in order to do his trick, and they do this using various social conventions and playing with your expectations and your cognitive biases. So there's this whole field of magicians' tricks and their ability to misdirect and use social cues that can be mined for new research paradigms in cognitive psychology, or indeed for new research questions. And so this poster was sort of a first stab at figuring out what we could do with this idea. And so what we did was we had me performing a magic trick, and we filmed people while they were watching it, and what we were doing was to see if we could elicit a really simple response. So, hey, how's it going? What are you looking at? So if you're like most people, when you hear that, you directly orient to the face of the person who asks you a direct question. There's a lot of really strong cognitive pressure to orient to the face of whoever is speaking to you directly, especially if they're asking a question. So what we thought would be interesting is to see if we could play against that one pressure with a separate opposing pressure in the context of viewing a magic trick, where you don't want to look at the magician's face because you want to keep looking at his hands so that you don't get fooled. There's a very strong social pressure not to look like a fool in front of your peers, in this case, the audience watching the magic trick, or indeed the performer himself. So we set up this experiment where we have people watching a magic trick, and at some point during the magic trick, we ask them, do you have a card? It's a card trick. They've selected a card. So these two opposing pressures, we measure whether or not they look up, and we change the circumstances. The main circumstance we changed in this was whether or not we asked them a direct question, and whether or not they were watching a live performer or watching a video performance of the same performer, removing the social pressure of the fact that there's a real person there for you to be fooled in front of.
So you're fooled.
You've been fooled. I've been fooling you this whole time. And what we found is that there does seem to be an effect. So in the video condition, people look up at my face pretty much no matter what I do. But in the live condition, people look up at my face less often, supporting the contention that there is some increased pressure when there is a live person there to not look up at someone's face because you don't want to be fooled when watching The Magician.
So forgive me for saying this, but I should care because...
well, this is an example of something that scientists do all the time, and that is test assumptions. One of the assumptions that people have about cognitive research is that people behave in exactly the same way when they're viewing a video of a person as when they're viewing a live person doing the same thing. This research is testing that assumption, and one thing that I always push for on this show and everywhere I go is that it's important to test your assumptions. That is the critical thinking way to go, that is the skeptical way to go, that is the scientific way to go. So this research that I'm doing is testing an assumption that is pretty basic to a lot of cognitive psychology research, namely that people act the same way when they're viewing a video as they do when they're viewing a live version of the same thing.
So how will you take this research and apply it to your trade when you go to the UK?
Oh, I know this one. So you're going to now go to live sex shows versus video sex? No, wrong direction.
Wow.
Well, aren't you going to Holland? Isn't that where? No, you're going to
London.
London.
Oh, actually, it's interesting. When I first visited London, I was wandering through Soho at night, and there's a lot of clubs, you know, sex clubs and things like that there. And this guy in a trench coat walks up from an alley, and he looks at me, and he says, fancy a peep show, sir? And I'm sort of like, no, thank you. And then he really creepily leans in and says, so what are you looking for? And I just got right out of there. So I'm definitely not applying this to any strange predilections I might have. But I hope to basically use this research and continue popularizing science and popularizing cognitive science and explaining to the world that we should be thinking more critically because we can't trust ourselves. We are susceptible to social pressure, to cognitive biases that will have us look at the magician's face or look wherever the government wants us to and not notice, for example, that they're smuggling something in over here, or when someone we're talking to, a psychic perhaps, is using our own cognitive biases against us, or that when scientists are, you know, saying that they have one conclusion, but the fact that they got it when people were watching videos of people rather than real people might change their results. So always check things. Always test your assumptions. Always check authority.
So Rob, you're leaving us for the UK pretty soon, but I would hope that we're still gonna hear from you on the show. We're still gonna
read $10.
Your entertaining blog post on RadioFreeThinker.com. Can we still expect to see that?
I will continue blogging, and I will probably be blogging more often because now that I don't have as much to do around here, I will be participating more with the website. I will continue posting tweets. I might get involved in the Radio Free Thinker Twitter account. But one thing that I will definitely be doing is recording things while I'm in the UK and sending them here. So you won't miss my voice. I'll still be around in the form of pre-recorded MP3s because there's a lot of really interesting people in the UK that you might not have access to interview otherwise.
And you could pursue your quest to stalk Richard Dawkins and get him that autographed book you've won.
I met Richard Dawkins when I was at TAM. Anyway, moving on, we have to go on to our skeptical highlights. And later this week, August 21st at 11 a.m., we have Cafe Inquiry at SFU Harbor Center in room 1600. The topic will be, should Canada abolish the monarchy? We've been talking about monarchs.
Hey, you're obsessed with monarchy.
I am obsessed with monarchy. Actually, there was an article in the Vancouver Sun just today about the Australian Prime Minister suggesting that when Queen Elizabeth eventually does, you know, die, Australia should declare itself a republic. And perhaps that is something that Canada should also consider.
Of course, Australia is in the middle of an election campaign right now, so that might have been hyperbole, but...
Well, I'll see what I can do about the Queen.
But no regicide, please. Thank you. What other skeptical highlights do we have?
Well, I have one. Recently in the United States, it's become legal to jailbreak your iPhone and iTouch. And for those people who would like to liberate their iPhone or iTouch...
And remember, the iPad as well.
And remember, there are risks to this, so do this at your own thing, but if you want to be one of those people who want to liberate your thing, go to Google and do red snow, and the O in snow is a zero, or ultra snow, and both those websites will tell you how to go through and jailbreak your iPhone so that you can put on community apps, free apps, that type of thing, things that are not controlled by Big Brother Apple.
And if you're listening live, there is a combination Café Scientifique and Skeptics in the Pub tonight at the Railway Club, starting around 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I think.
Yeah, around that time frame. Yeah. Get there early, grab a seat, get a burger, grab a beer, and sit back for some good science and then some good socializing.
And my final skeptical highlight is that it has been a rare pleasure working with both of you and the other previous hosts of the show. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Robbie, it's been a joy having you on the show, and I think I speak for everybody when I say that it's been an honor.
Bon voyage and happy trails.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. See you next week on Radio Freethinker. Disconnecting from